I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast.
Today, we are happy to be joined by Mark A. Altman and Ed Gross. They are the co-authors of Slayers and Vampires, an oral history of Joss Whedon's Buffy and Angel. They also wrote the two-volume oral history of Star Trek called The 50-Year Mission, two of Patrick's favorite things. Mark and Ed, thank you for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks for having us, guys.
This is always a challenge for me when we have more than one guest because I ask questions and I don't direct them at anybody. So I'm going to go ahead and apologize for that now. But why don't you, you know, we're going to probably get into both things. But Mark, when does the new book come out?
The new book comes out September 26th and we're hitting the trifecta. You know, it's the hardcover, the digital book, and also the audiobook. So same thing that we had with 50 Year Mission. And much like 50 Year Mission, it is a very heavy book. So we always say if you don't like it, it works great as a doorstop or for exercising and calisthenics, even if you don't like the book. But they're very hefty tomes. I think the word tome was invented to describe books.
Now, Ed, with the audio version of these books, when you have an oral history, I've read quite a few. I'm a big fan of oral histories in general, and it's essentially presented in a way often where it's a bunch of people in a room talking about a specific subject. So how does the audio version of this, is it told by one person? Are there multiple people on these?
Well, when 50 Year Mission came out, it was a few different people. It was like, what is it, Mark, three or four people? I think reading.
It was more like five, actually, yeah.
Okay. So they would take on, just announce the name of the person who their quote, you know, the quote's from, and then speak that person's line, so to speak. So several people covering it, males for males, females for females, and worked out well in 50 Year Mission.
Oh, yeah, you know, whoever they used a great group of people, and it was really funny because I was a co-EP on Agent X, which is a TV short-lived TV show on TNT, and all of a sudden I get a call from this guy who was a stand-in on Agent X, and he says, "You never believe what I'm doing the audiobook of." And I said, "What?" And he said, 50 Year Mission. I said, "That's awesome." But apparently he wasn't allowed to actually ask me how to pronounce the names. So when you listen to the book, it makes me nuts because they mispronounce half the names, particularly, you know, I love when they do Idic as I-D-I-C. And if they just let him talk to me, he specifically said, "Look, I know the author. Let me ask him." They say, "Oh, that's not allowed." It's like Brazil. This is bureaucracy. You're not allowed to talk to him and get this information. But they did a great job. I love listening to the book. People love the book. But, you know, John, it's funny you mentioned the oral histories and how fond you are of them. You know, Ed and I are as well. And, you know, we were very lucky to get, you know, really great reviews for the books. And 99% of the feedback's great. But every once in a while you get, "I don't understand. It's just a bunch of quotes strung together." And it's like, no, that's what's so great about it, particularly when you're dealing with a subject like Buffy or Star Trek, which is like Rashomon, where you ask six different people and they all have six different opinions about what happened. Rather than us having to be sort of the voice of God, sort of rendering a verdict as to what really happened, we can let everybody have their own unique perspective. And, you know, the inspiration for these sort of came. There was that great Tom Shale Saturday Night Live oral history. And then one that I'm even fonder of, which is an oral history of MTV called I Want My MTV, because it's funny and it's weird and it's insightful. And you find out what happened to Billy Squire's career. And it serves a lot of master. And that was really what inspired the Star Trek book. And then based on the success of the Star Trek book, we wrote the Buffy book.
Well, that's awesome, and I definitely want to get into the process of writing these books, because I imagine it presents many unique challenges, and so we'll save that for the main section. But before we get to that, hey, everybody. Thanks for backing us on Patreon. It's our patreon.com/functionalnerds. If you're one of the people that back us, thank you so much. If you're not, consider doing that. It's over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Now we're going to get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Ed, why don't you go first with your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is an oldie but a goodie. The cop show, undercover cop show, Wise Guy. starring Ken Wolf. First binge-worthy TV show that introduced serialized storytelling, and it has aged remarkably well. So,
where can you stream that now?
Yeah, you can. It's on Hulu.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. He's a music arc because the art music never got cleared, so that's been unreleased. So
interesting.
Oh, so do they pump different music in it, or do they just
cut that out completely because it was too expensive because they told the stories in arcs?
Oh, wow.
Ed could do a whole episode just on Wise Guy. So a very special episode of Functional Nerds.
That show, that was one of the first shows that like my mom watched and I watched was Wise Guys. We both... You know, up until that point, it's like I had my stuff, she had her stuff, and I was not going to watch anything that she liked because, you know, she's my mom.
Right.
But that was the show that like got us both sitting down together on the couch going, wow, this is really good.
It was really good. So when you want to do an episode on Wise Guy, let me know.
No, that's going to be for the spinoff, Ed. That's going to be for Dysfunctional Nerds. No, we both love Wise Guy. I mean, in fact, at San Diego Comic-Con this year, we did a panel celebrating the 30th anniversary of Wise Guy, and we brought a bunch of the producers and executives and then also sort of professional fans, you know, like Mark Guggenheim from Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow, and just basically sang the praises of Wise Guy for an hour, and it was phenomenal. And to have David Burke, who was such an inspiration on so many of us who worked on the show, was the EP of Wise Guy back in the 80s. And I had a similar experience to you. I mean, I used to watch it with my dad, and it was a very seminal show for me, and it was great to pack that room to see that so many people still remembered it and loved it, because it really is a very seminal show in the history of TV, although you don't often see it written about as much as sort of, you know, the LA Laws and the Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere and sort of some of the shows in the 80s that changed television. I mean, Wise Guy deserves to sort of be in that pantheon.
When are we going to see a San Diego Comic-Con panel on Tales from the Gold Monkey?
We did talk about that. Yeah, Tales from the Gold. Well, I'm holding out for Bring Them Back Alive. We'll do that one.
Mark, what's your pick this week?
My pick? Well, you know, since we're sort of all talking about the Emmys this week, I think I'm going to go with something more recent, Feud, you know, Betty versus Joan, the miniseries. Absolutely phenomenal. Ryan Murphy kicked off the new Feud miniseries with and the performances by Jessica Lange is phenomenal. I have a tough time with Susan Sarandon because of her Jill Stein support, but she was great too, begrudgingly, I must admit. And it was absolutely a phenomenal miniseries. And it prompted me to go back and watch Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is like the greatest bonus feature of that miniseries of all time. So it was it's just phenomenal. And I strongly, you know, recommend if somebody hasn't seen it to check it out. I mean, it's an acting masterclass, but, you know, writing, directing, it's just sensational.
Fantastic. Really good. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
So I'm going a little bit different direction. I'm so, you remember I burned through all the Elizabeth Moon books, the Vada War books on Audible.
Mm-hmm.
I have now burned through, I'm on the last one that's been released so far of Tanya Huff's Confederation series, mm-hmm. which is Marguerite Gavin is the narrator on those. And they're military sci-fi, but they have like this arc that's kind of going through it, and it changes over time. So the first few books are about the main character, Torin Kerr, who is in the Confederation Marines. And essentially humans were brought into the Confederation just to fight a war for the elder races who have evolved beyond violence. They no longer fight or anything, but this other people have decided to start fighting them, and they don't know what to do. So they bring in younger races and give them weapons and say, here, you go off and fight our war for us, and we'll give you technology and stuff. So that's kind of the premise. Torin Kerr goes from, I believe, just a staff sergeant all the way up to a gunny. And then the war ends, and then a new series called Peacemaker starts, where she now has to... adjust to civilian life. So very interesting series. I'm enjoying it. Tanya Huff, the Confederation books.
Nice. My pick real quick is The Princess Diarist by Carrie Fisher. It is her final autobiography. thing in this book is that she talks about the affair that she had with Harrison Ford while they were filming the very first Star Wars movie. It's not a lurid retelling of that time. It is actually very sweet, and it's really a fun book if you're a big fan of the movies, as I am, as many people are. I really enjoyed it. She actually publishes some of her journals from the time. There's like a section in the middle where it's her, you know, 19-year-old Carrie Fisher's journals of that time. So it's really, if you're a fan, it's definitely a nice little insight into that time and what was going on.
Does she address the controversial cocaine fingernail picture?
No, that does not come up in it. Yeah, it's more, you know, wholesome, I suppose.
Well, and she did actually talk to Harrison Ford before she released that book. Yeah. Hey, I'm going to talk about this. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, she doesn't really badmouth him or anything. It's fairly. I mean, look, he was married and 14 years older than she was.
Yeah,
and kids,
but if you look at Star Wars interviews at the time, like, he was hitting on the reporters who was asking him questions about the movie. It's there's some that are kind of pretty creepy. You know, where he's just like focused on the reporter and just, you know, hitting on her.
Well, there's that, I guess. But anyway, so yeah, Princess Diaries, Carrie Fisher. Okay, so back to...
You want to hear my funny Carrie Fisher story?
Yes, of course.
I was at New York Comic Con, and, you know, backstage, they sort of bring you to the stage in these golf carts. So I'm in the bowels of New York City at Javits Center. And so suddenly they stop. Carrie Fisher gets into the golf cart. So, and with us, and there are about four of us heading towards the stage to do various things. And she just sits there in silence. And then she turns around and just throws glitter on all of us. And so I get out to do my panel, and everybody says, "What the hell are you covered in glitter?" And they're all saying, "You look ridiculous." I said, "Yeah, Carrie Fisher threw this on me." And then they all thought it was the coolest thing ever. That was my big run-in with Carrie Fisher. I did want to talk to her about Hannah and her sisters, but we never made it that far. So
cool. She actually does, in the book, she actually gets quite a bit into the convention circuit and how she accepted that as part of her life later on, that she went around and doing these. And she details many encounters and has an overall very positive opinion of it, but kind of talks about a little bit of the craziness that comes up when you have fans coming up to get autographs signed. It's a really interesting read. I really
enjoy. Yeah, no, I hear it's great. I want to read it.
Definitely worth time. So
nobody said Slayers and Vampires for their pick for this week. Oh,
I didn't get it. You know, we get so many books sent to us, and your publicist contacted me to get you guys on the show, but we didn't get the book yet. So I'm hoping
they're dropping the ball.
Yeah, I know. What's up? Anyway, oral histories. So Ed, what's your first encounter with oral histories? You know, Mark had mentioned some. What's your first encounter with them, and how did that lead you to eventually collaborating with Mark on writing one or two?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there had been articles over the years that I'd read, and then Mark, when we first started talking about the idea of doing something for Star Trek's 50th, suggested I read the Saturday Night Live and MTV ones. So in a sense, that was my gateway into true oral history books. I'd seen some articles in the format. And when I looked at it at first, I was like, this is impossible. How the hell are we going to put together an oral history telling 50 years of this? And somehow we did, you know, and it's a fascinating, it really is a fascinating tool for telling a story, because it's a lighter read, no matter how long the book is. You can zoom in and out on certain sections. You can pick it up anytime. It's really a very different, exciting way to tell a story.
You're abridging the story. You forgot about the five times you asked me, "Hey, we should do a book for the 50th anniversary." I said, "No, no, no." And then I happened to read the MTV book, and then I called you up and I cracked and I said, "Well, maybe."
Well, once we got into it, it never stopped.
It never stopped. That's true. We've both been covering Star Trek for many years. I mean, Ed for nearly 30 years as a journalist, and then, you know, all the years when I was a journalist before I started doing movies and TV. And but this was a hard, crazy 2 years in which we were like doing the books. And, you know, it started off where it was one book, the 50 year mission. But there was so much great material that we ended up having to, you know, bifurcate it into two books. And thankfully, we had an amazing editor at St. Martin's who was willing to do that because he realized how great the material was. I mean, we warned him that the book was going to be too long and that we think it should be split up to two books. And he said, "I'll be the judge of that." And he read it. And next week he called up and he said it's two books.
So I, as John mentioned, I am a Star Trek person. I'm a Star Trek nerd. I grew up on Star Trek. I'm curious, did the name Nana Graysmith ever come up in your research into the Star Trek?
Nana Graysmith?
Yes.
No, I can say with a complete assurance. No, that name never came up. So tell us why that is significant in the annals of 51 years of Star Trek now, as of yesterday.
She put on the first convention.
Nana Graysmith?
Graysmith.
Graysmith. She put on the first. Are you talking about the library in New Jersey?
No, I'm talking about she. So I grew up in Fresno, and I apologize for that. But my cousin he loved bowling, and so he would invite me to bowling. And I would go on Friday nights and hang out. And I started bowling with this family, the Graysmiths. And I would be their alternate. And just to be there with everybody. And they were very nice. They were very kind. I called them the wolf people because they had a uniform, which was a wolf shirt. And being young and nerdy, and you know, I would wear my Star Trek shirts. And she finally said, "So you like Star Trek?" And I said, "Yeah." She says, "Have you ever read the book I wrote about it?" And I said, "No. What book did you write?" She says, "Well, you know, I'm Nana Graysmith, and I wrote a book about putting on Star Trek conventions because my best friend and I put on the first one."
Now that's interesting. I think there's some people that would dispute her assertion that she did the first one, because the technically the first Star Trek convention was really in a library in New Jersey when the show was still on the air, and there were about 100 people. There. And then, you know, it was sort of an East Coast phenomenon. When did she say that she did her first Star Trek?
She didn't tell me the year, but she said that they were like the cast was all there. This was after the show, before the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the entire cast was there and they meted and greeted people. And then they had an after party in a hotel room where Jimmy Doohan got drunk. And she sat in his lap most of the night.
Well, it's not a Tuesday if Jimmy Doohan wasn't drunk.
And she sat in his lap most of the night, and they just sat around telling stories.
Yeah.
And that was what she had told me at the time.
If the entire class came, it would have been later then. It was not that first Star Trek convention in New York.
Okay.
Because the entire cast did not come to those early conventions. It was a while before they started to feel it out and realize it was. And, you know, but I don't doubt that she did one of the early conventions for sure. But it really was an East Coast phenomenon. Some sort of migrated to the West Coast. But we did talk to a lot of the people involved with all those early conventions. But not Nana.
She also claimed to have been somewhere nearby involved when Gene and Majel had their first baby.
She delivered the rod.
No. She was there, and she provided them with a blanket that she made, like a quilt. For the
wow, this book sounds like it's riveting.
So I don't know. I was just curious. Like when I was young and hanging out and I was super into Star Trek at the time, I mean these stories were like milk to me. I was just so into them.
Because they were trying to sell you the blanket, you know, with the Starfleet thing. This blanket, you know, swaddled Rod Roddenberry. $1,000.
I will say one of the best parts of social media, in my opinion, is the fact that Diane Duane friended me on Facebook and we actually chat.
Isn't that great when people you sort of idolized and respected as a kid or you know even older, you know, sort of because of social media become acquaintances or even friends? Or it's, I mean, I remember I was like, James Garner's daughter friended me on Twitter, you know, followed me. I was like, I thought that was the coolest thing. It was like Maverick's daughter on The Great Escape. I mean, it was like, it was cool. So.
Well, I'm so much older. I grew up watching the old soap opera Dark Shadows.
Oh, yeah.
And in the 80s, I actually used to, on Sundays, go over to the house of Jonathan Frid, who played Barnabas Collins on that show. So for a kid who grew up on Dark Shadows to then be at his place, going through his files to write a book at the time that I was working on.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
That's pretty astounding when you get that close to a childhood idol.
Well, you know.
Hey, I was on a
I'll take you. Sorry, go ahead.
I was on a Southwest flight with Tuvok.
Okay, let me tell you something about Tuvok. Our editor, we can't get through an interview without making, we love our editor, but his favorite episode of Star Trek is Tuvix. And we love to give him shit because we just think that is, not a, the most ridiculous thing. I remember, you know, when we first sold the book and we're talking and, you know, we all love Deep Space Nine, talking about how underappreciated it is and all this stuff. And then he says, you know what's underappreciated? Tuvix. And now you can hear a pin drop because we're like, oh, my God, this guy is nuts. But I was going to say, you know, Ed's Jonathan Frid story. Of course, I'll take you and raise you one because, you know, obviously when I did Free Enterprise, my first movie, you know, to do, you know, which I did with Shatner, you know, to work with your childhood idol, you know, on a movie is pretty extraordinary. And of course, working with Bill. Thank you, Ed. There's a litany of great Free Enterprise stories, but we're not here to talk about that. And you know, it's like, oh my God, I'm like, it's 18 years since we did Free Enterprise, and it's like, I don't want to talk about that anymore. But but yeah, you know, it's I always I just have to do that because I don't want Ed to win the battle of the bands here.
Hey, I will throw it out there. There's a picture of me with George R. R. Martin, and we're both holding Hugo Awards. So there.
Nice. There you go. Excellent. I didn't say Ice Dragons, but okay.
Now, Ed, you'd mentioned when you're reading these oral histories how they're, I think you actually used the word, how they're so easy to read. And that's not a knock on them. That's a strength of them, I think. Now, my guess, because I've read a few of them over the years, and I would agree with you, that because they're easy to read, I suspect for the author, they're anything but easy to write.
No, I mean, the way I sort of capture that, the how hard it was, is there was a point there where my son, he was 24 at the time, was walking in just to talk to me, and he kept coming in while I was working on the Deep Space Nine section. And he would interrupt me, and I'd talk to him, and I'd go back to it, and this happened like 5 or 6 times within an hour. And finally, I looked at him, I go, Dennis, I said, you need to understand something. You see this transcript? You see that quote? That quote has to be somehow put into a 50,000-word chapter in the exact right place to be able to make it flow with all the other stories that are going in there to keep the flow of the tale going. And he got it, and he left me alone while I did that. But that's sort of the challenge of it. You're taking all these voices and bringing them together and making it sound like it's one conversation with a bunch of people.
No, and Ed is brilliant at that, and you're absolutely right. You know, one of the pet peeves I have is sometimes people put the books compiled by Ed Gross and Mark Bolan, and that makes me insane because we're not compiling stuff. First of all, they're all interviews we did. You know, 99% of it's interviews we did. A couple of things maybe from Paley Fest or something else if somebody's passed away, but. You know, generally it's all our research, all our material. And then of course, you know, we're writing all the bridge material and you want to write as little of that bridge material as possible. You want it to flow as though you're having a dinner party with 500 of the most interesting people in the world who are just telling the story linear fashion. you know, there's a real art to it. It's just super challenging to do it well. Ed does it extremely well, and but it takes a lot of time. And you know, you also have to sort of make sure you have the interviews that you can do a run of a certain subject. If one person talks about one thing, it's very hard to sort of, you know, tell that story with one person. And you also don't want these huge chunks where it's, you know, one person telling a story for 3 pages. You want to be able to alternate between different people and sort of build it. So there really is an art to writing these oral histories. They're quite challenging, but it's not a question of really cherry picking quotes. I mean, even in the interview process, you're sort of thinking, this is something, a story I want to tell, and you want to get it from multiple people so you can sort of seamlessly weave that story through the, you know, several voices. It's been very eye-opening, but we love the format, and that's why we've embraced it so much with the Star Trek books and then Buffy and now with our next book.
You mentioned the Deep Space Nine section. Did that section drag on and on and on and on and on?
No,
it didn't.
It did not. Criticizing Deep Space Nine?
Yes, I'm.
That was the Voyager section.
I love that section.
DS9 is not my favorite of the series because it did feel like, I mean. And I guess Avery Brooks has gone nuts now, is from what I, like, he's like insane, like crazy.
Avery's always been a little crazy. You know, I mean, you know, and I got to tell you, we have a lot of Avery stories in the book, but there are a lot of Avery stories we couldn't put in the book. But, you know, it's just, he's always been an interesting guy. Let's put it that way. But, you know, I mean, I unlike you, I think, you know, Ed and I are both huge Deep Space Nine fans.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, certainly by the time he shaved his hair and grew the goatee, you know, they finally sort of let Avery be Avery in those last couple of seasons. I mean, he's sensational. I mean, he was really finding his way for, you know, a while.
For a long time, it felt like he only had two modes. Like his ability to emote was either raising his voice or getting really quiet.
Yeah, you know, he was uncomfortable with the character. He never really knew what the character was, and they were sort of trying to take Avery. But they didn't want him to look like Hawk, you know.
Right.
Spencer. So they gave him a different look. You know, he was playing a character he didn't really understand. They were sort of finding the show. I mean, no one would argue that he was the strength of that show initially. I mean, it was really this sort of deep bench of supporting characters with, like, you know, Andrew Robinson's Garrick and with Terry and with, you know, Gul Dukat. And they really had, you know, such a rich panoply of characters. Avery was not one of them. But I do feel that when they sort of found how to write for him in the later seasons, he's really phenomenal.
Moogie.
That's a show that people are really starting to discover now on Netflix, you know, how, you know, since it really was sort of a progenitor of binge TV as well, because it was one of the more serialized Star Trek shows. You know, I mean, look, eventually the shows really start to go off the rails, and I mean, I know we're not really here to talk about Star Trek, but I mean, for Ed and I, of course, the original is the Paramount one is the best, the zenith of the series. But you know, and then Next Generation is a wonderful show as well, and we love Deep Space Nine. You know, after that, the less said, the better.
Now, you know, so even you bringing it to putting together writing the Buffy book, when you're conducting these interviews, now, do you just go out and say, like, all right, we're gonna write about this particular topic, so we want to interview this list of people? How do you go about preparing for the interview? Do you guys get together and try to get a form of what the book might tell first? Do you wait and let the interview people, Ed, how do you do that? The process?
I basically approach my interviews as I always have. I intend to make them conversational. And by making them conversational, it's having the knowledge, working knowledge of the subject in general. When you get people for these kinds of books, generally speaking, we found that they're very interested in taking as much time as we need to tell the stories. James Masters, for instance, was on the phone with me probably for, you know, a total of like 7 hours talking about Buffy and Angel. So what you do is you just go in and have a conversation and you just start talking about the show in general and the character in general. And what you find is that leads into a flow in that conversation. So you're talking about the character, which impacts on an episode, you know, and then that episode impacts on the actor. How did I feel doing this? And you just get that going. And if you have the time, you're not in like 15 minutes and out, then you have the opportunity to craft the book basically while you're talking to them, rather than, I feel anyway, coming up with a big outline and then going in and saying, okay, I have to cover A, B, C, D, and D. You know,
yeah,
I mean?
Ed, you're being extremely modest. You know, Ed has a really unique talent. I mean, a lot of it has to do because he's been doing it for so many years, but at putting people at ease, I've never seen, and it's funny because most of these he does as phoners, he doesn't do them in person, where, you know, he's so well versed in the subject, which is such a refreshing thing for a lot of the talent to deal with somebody who is so familiar with the subject matter and asks such incisive questions that he really puts them at ease. I've never seen so many people then say, as much time as you need, I will give you. I mean, Ed will call me and say, oh, I'm doing, you know, hour number six with so-and-so. And I'm like, I can't, what is left to talk about? But, you know, I think it comes from the place that Ed is a true fan. He is passionate about the things that he is passionate about, but he's extremely knowledgeable at the same time. And I'm amazed because Ed will run into somebody at Comic-Con or something that he interviewed 20 years ago on the phone, and they're like, "Oh my God, I'm finally meeting Ed Gross, and I've seen it." And I don't know. He has this pixie dust about him that is extraordinary, the way he connects with people.
Thanks, Mark.
No, it's true. I mean, that's the only nice thing I'm going to say about you today.
But nice thing to say about me. Good.
Now, Mark, do you interview as well? Is it, do you guys split it up? How does the interview
go? Yeah, I do. And I have a different approach. I tend, because obviously I'm in LA and he's in New York, I have a different approach. I like to sit down with people over lunch or preferably over drinks and get them to talk. And I find that, you know, interviewing people in person tends to be better because it's harder for them to say, oh, I'm getting another call, I have to run away, or, you know, and get them to sort of open up in a more social environment. You know, particularly on an issue, you know, Buffy is a less, there's less drama with Buffy than there was with Star Trek. With Star Trek, it was more important to get people to be candid because, you know, as I've said at conventions, there's more, you know, backstabbing and skullduggery in the history of Star Trek than any episode of Game of Thrones, which is true. Buffy, while it had its ups and downs behind the scenes, isn't quite as dramatic. So it was a little different approach. But yeah, the one thing I had to do with Buffy that I didn't do with Star Trek was I really had to watch the show again. Because even though I'm a big fan, my wife's a huge fan, I it'd been a while since I watched it, and I don't know it backwards and forwards the way I know Star Trek backwards and forwards. But I don't tend to really prepare. I sort of make it a freewheeling conversation. But that's the way, you know, I just, you know, it's been years since I was a journalist. So, you know, I really the majority of what I do now is, you know, producing and writing for television. So it's funny because a lot of the people that I interview are people that maybe I've worked with in the past or that I know. It's like if I'm sitting down with somebody, I mean, there are a couple of people I didn't want to interview because I know so well, like John Frakes on the Star Trek book. I asked Ed to do it. And in fact, I remember it was funny. Ed called me and Frakes and I were on a location scout for librarians. And I said, oh, Ed Gross is calling. And so I handed the phone to him and he'd go, Ed, what the hell do you want? We're in the middle of something important. And, you know, so, and it was the same thing. It's like, I mean, Sean Astin, who directed an episode of Angel, literally was doing an episode of Librarians for me. And I interviewed him in his trailer after he wrapped the last day. And I said, hey, I got to talk to you for this Buffy book I'm doing before you head back to LA, because we shoot in Portland. And so we sat in the trailer for literally an hour and a half and I interviewed him about Buffy. I said, okay, now you can go home. So, you know, it's a little different, but at the same time, it was reconnecting with a lot of people that I knew in the past when I used to write these articles for CineFantastic, you know, these huge double issues about Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. And,
I think I have those.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of at the beginning. It was right before the internet really became a big thing. And, you know, I was one of the first people to sort of do episode reviews in CineFantastic when Next Generation was on the air. And, you know, it created a lot of problems for me with the talent because obviously I was very candid. And so if I said something negative, I'd be on the phone for an hour with Piller trying to defend Voyager to me, saying, I can't believe you pressed this, you know. And then I had to like salvage my relationship at the same time while still being honest about, well, no, Michael, I disagree. But the great thing about like someone like Piller was he would like get into an argument with you, but he would never resent you for saying it. He would disagree. But he would never like close the door. Like he never like said, oh, Mark, I'm not going to talk to you anymore because you were mean or you said something nasty about an episode I like, which was a great thing about him. You know, that wasn't true of everyone, you know, on the show where they could really resent the fact that if you sort of savaged an episode or said something bad about a show, they would take it personally. And that but it was really great to reconnect with so many of the people. And, you know, obviously having hindsight now, looking back, we were able to really be very honest.
So first off, Librarians, love it.
Love oh, thanks.
Show. Great show. Second, you mentioned the drama and less drama. And I know there was a lot of drama with Star Trek in the convention scene, the fandoms and stuff. And when you look at Buffy and Angel, you have people like James Marsters and Claire Kramer who go to a lot of conventions. Like Claire Kramer, we have Denver Comic Con now. And
right.
it's a baby con. It's like less than 5 years old, I want to say. And it's already the third or fourth largest Comic Con in the nation. And mm-hmm. and Claire Kramer has been, I think, at every single one of them. She interviews people on the main stage and talks to them when they come in. So and she has been great with fans, and you know, she does a lot. And she just had, you know, the one season is Glory. You know,
the one arc.
Yeah. And I still to this day, I'll quote it and I'll say, you know, this thing I'm doing right now, this beating you to death, this is valuable time out of my life that I will never get back. you know, and she's been awesome. James Marsters has been awesome. I know some of the other cast has embraced the fandom. Sarah Michelle Gellar loves her fans, but she doesn't talk much about Buffy.
That's true. But she has been more, you know, it's interesting because certainly when the show went off the air, she was done. You know,
yeah.
She was not, there was a while where she was not talking about Buffy and you sensed there was a certain resentment. And it's only in the last year or two where she's really, particularly with the anniversary, where she's starting to embrace it. And I think she's realizing what an impact it had on a generation of empowering a generation of young women. You know, so I think she's taking it, you know, she's gone through that evolution, you know, as she gets older, where she's come to reappreciate it. But I think partially it's because of the distance. You know, one thing about Sarah was she took it, you know, the show very, very seriously when she was doing it. And she was in virtually every scene. And that was a show that had tons of night shoots that went extremely late every night. So it was brutal. I mean, she had no life. So when 7 years was over, she was done.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't want to hear the words Buffy ever again. And I think it's sort of like PTSD, you know, not to compare the two, but it's like entertainment PTSD, which is far less severe. But it's like, so she didn't want to hear anything about Buffy for a long time. And I think only now she's starting to embrace it again. You know, in a way, whereas, you know, Joss has always been extremely proud of, you know, the show and what they accomplished. And, you know, somebody like, you know, Claire, I mean, she's turned it into a living because she has that geeknation.com, which is her website. And she's going to all the conventions and she's very associated with Buffy. And, you know, she's really managed to do a lot with it, you know, so.
That was one of the things we discovered on both Star Trek and Buffy. We didn't really cover the convention scene in Buffy and Angel, but all of those actors have been very candid.
If only we had tracked down Gray Smith or Gray Skull. She did the first Buffy convention, too.
But they all talk about the fact that long after these shows are over, they do have a career based on these conventions, mm-hmm. whether it's here, internationally, or whatever. That they can't believe that people want to hear them and what they have to say and get their autographs and all that stuff. So they do have another career.
They do. It's fascinating, right? And I think that their experiences have now influenced other shows and other actors. So you have something like Supernatural, right? Where those guys are all over the conventions and they love it. You have Arrow, right? And Supergirl, they do the conventions. It's interesting that the Grant Gustafson, whatever, the Flash, he does not do the conventions.
Grant Gustin, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are two reasons for doing it. I mean, one, obviously now with the social media footprint, it's great just, you know, that fan adoration, it's magnified, you know, through social media and everything. But I think also a lot of them, and I've heard this, you know, the money now is so cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs that it's really hard to say no to it. I mean, you have, you know, the people that had a career on one show who are now still making a really good living just off the conventions. And then they're telling sort of the younger generation, you don't know what's next, so take advantage of it while you can. And so they're all doing conventions because the money is so crazy good. I mean, and it's really, I mean, it's not like the old days. I mean, you know, now the way they pay people is they paid in advance and a guarantee at these conventions. It used to be paid a couple thousand dollars, you get a plane ticket, they came, they signed. You know, now it's all about the autographing, you know, and they pay them X amount of money that they're guaranteed to sign autographs. And, you know, it's really become a business. You know, the art, the fan of it all is gone. And they just want to, I mean, they barely look up. These people have become a machine, you know, just signing this stuff and you know, counting the money. And a lot of it's cash. So yeah. I think that people have really embraced this, you know, as a business. And I've heard that. I've heard veteran actors, you know, say to younger actors who are on a hot show, it's like, do the conventions while you can. You don't want to, you know, the money is not crazy and you don't know what's next, to take advantage of it while you can. Because, you know, they're not hiring the people, and you have to be on a certain kind of show. I mean, like the stars of NCIS or The Good Wife are not, you know, being getting calls to come do these conventions. But, you know, the CW shows, they can't get enough of them.
Yep. And wasn't it DeForest Kelly who back in the day, like, would not sign anything unless you paid him?
I don't know if that was, you know, D was just, I don't think it was D, because D was like, is one of the sweetest, nicest guys. He was just unbelievable. I don't think that doesn't sound like him, because he was so appreciative of the fans and he meant it. You know, he wasn't one of these guys who's full of shit. I mean, he was really, more than any of them, the most real guy. But I'm sure there were people who said, yeah, I won't sign anything unless you pay for sure.
So you mentioned that you're working on another one. I don't know if you could tell us what the next book is going to be from you two fellas there.
Yeah. you know, we haven't officially announced it, so we probably should wait, but it's something really cool and it's in the genre. And I mean, anybody who follows the things that we love, whether it be Star Trek or and Buffy, could probably take a guess and have a good idea of what the next book is going to be. I mean, we have to turn that in shortly. So, but I'm sure that the tour is going to announce it soon because we're really excited about that one too. I mean, the Buffy book was really such a joy, and you know, we talked about Deep Space Nine. You know, how shining a light on that for us was one of the joys of the Trek book. I think shining a light on Angel was something that, you know, was a real joy for this book, particularly because it's another show that sort of is in the shadow of a bigger show. You know, obviously everyone talks about Buffy and what a groundbreaking, iconic show that is, and Angel sort of gets lost. But Angel's another show that really, you know, sort of started out sort of rough and tumble, but by the end it really found its voice and is an amazing show. And, you know, Ed really focused on Angel, and I thought did an amazing job with that.
Well, and Ed and I were talking about it. To this day, I tell people Wesley Wyndham Price, I think, has the best character arc of any character in the Buffyverse, because he goes from bumbling kind of slapstick comedic element to complete and total badass by the end of Angel.
Totally. To go from this milquetoast cowardly guy to, you know, sort of Pierce Brosnan as Bond, you know, kick-ass kind of guy. I mean, yeah, it's really amazing the arc that he goes through, and that it's credible. I mean, that was the amazing thing about Joss and the writing team at Mutant Enemy is they could pull off these big moves and these big twists and very effectively, and you would buy it. I mean, who would have ever thought that Wesley Wyndham Price would be, what was his line, you know, a vampire hunter or a demon hustler or whatever.
Rogue.
Rogue. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible evolution of that character. And it happened again. Look at Spike. The evolution that Spike goes through from just this loathsome baddie, you know, who's like the Sid and Nancy of the vampire set with Juliet Landau, you know, to the fact that he becomes Buffy's love interest. And I mean, in fact, you go to the conventions and the fans, they like Spike more than they like Angel. I mean, I find shocking. And then, you know, it's an incredible. And then when he's on Angel, it's a whole different thing. I mean, we joke about in the book that, I mean, what sounds worse than the log line for season four, you know, Angel joins an evil law firm in Los Angeles and fights, you know, the demons. It's like, it sounds ridiculous. I mean, who would watch? It sounds like Manimal, but basically.
Numfar, do the dance of shame.
And it's phenomenal. What a great season. Who would have ever thought? And they pull it off. So I think they're really great at subverting expectations and doing things you wouldn't expect. And, you know, obviously the show gave birth to so many talented showrunners. I mean, Marty Noxon and David Fury Tim Minear. And I mean, it was really a mentorship that paid incredible dividends, because you have Drew Goddard. I mean, it just goes on and on. Stephen DeKnight, all these people came out of the apprenticeship at Mutant Enemy. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Now you have in the background of your image the Smile Time version of Angel hanging on your wall.
Right.
When the creator of The Tick is brought in to help you write episodes, I think that is pure genius.
It is. You know what's funny is Ben Edlund is like the most amazed at the direction that Angel took. Besides Smile Time, it's a story we've told at conventions, but the highlight for Ben is the fact that in season four, you have a vampire who has to go to another dimension because humans can't breathe there to deal with crab people to find out the name of a goddess who is ruling the earth so you can go back and remove her from power. Where else on television are you finding that? And he couldn't believe it himself. Now, this is a guy who does some pretty crazy stuff, and he was blown away by the insanity of all that.
Yeah, I remember when I first started seeing his name appear in credits and stuff on Angel, I'm sitting there going, no freaking way. Yeah. That I mean, I honestly, I think that was brilliant. And I don't know who made that decision to bring him in, but I think that that's when you started seeing some very different things in Angel that worked so damn well.
They pulled off Smile Time.
Pulled off Smile Time.
And directed it, and it's the stupidest premise in the world.
Next to Tuvix.
But then you've got Angel as a Muppet walking down the hall with a sword behind his neck.
Doing the hero walk. Yes. And the whole scene with the werewolf chick, and he's like, no, stop. And she's just like, you see cotton and fur and all kinds of shit flying. It's hilarious.
No, wee little puppet man. It's just fantastic. It's just crazy.
Oh.
Well, I feel like we could just let this go for a long time. But so the book is going to be out very soon. What's the date again? You guys let us know when the book is coming.
September 26th. And you know, we're lucky that in this world in which, you know, book things sort of become an antediluvian premise, you know, it's bookstores everywhere where you can find one. Obviously Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, you know, it's everywhere. And, you know, whether it's the Kindle or the actual hardcover or the audiobook. And, we're really excited about it because the reaction to the Star Trek book was so gratifying. And I think that the Buffy and Angel book is at that same level. And we were really lucky. I mean, Booklist, you know, and Publishers Weekly were all very generous about this book as well. So, you know, when we go into it, you know, we want to do a level of scholarship that hasn't been done about these shows, but at the same time, make them fun. So they're good anecdotes, they're good stories, because we want them to be books that appeal to the layman as well as the super fan, and that the super fan can get something out of it they've never heard before. I mean, we did that with the Star Trek book effectively, I thought. And with Buffy, it was the same thing. We wanted to appeal to the super fan, but at the same time, someone who may be just interested in television or how television is made could still enjoy it without being like a diehard Buffy or Angel fan.
Cool. So the book is Slayers and Vampires. The authors are Mark A. Altman and Ed Gross. So go and check that out. You guys mentioned conventions. So are you guys going to be making any appearances at upcoming conventions?
Yeah, we're going to be we'll be doing a signing at the Tor Books booth at New York Comic Con. And Thursday, the I believe it's the 5th, we're doing a panel on the book, which is a part of New York Comic Con Presents. So it's on the website over at the Hammerstein Ballroom. So tickets, I believe, are still available for that. And then also we're doing a Star Trek panel that Thursday night as well about the next 50 years of Star Trek. So we'll be talking about Discovery and also some talking about the book and maybe a couple of special surprises. And then I'll be doing an additional panel on that Saturday about writing for television with a panel of writer-producers from TV shows talking about writing and producing for TV on Saturday at the Hammerstein Ballroom as well. So we got a pretty packed New York Comic Con schedule, but we're looking forward to it.
Excellent. Any other projects that either of you want to let our listeners know about?
Just the current you can't talk about.
Yeah, I just finished directing a movie called Can't Have You, which will be out next year. Which I'm really excited about. You know, obviously the book I'm doing now with Ed. I think the new season 3 of The Librarians is coming out on DVD this month or next. If people want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Mark A. Altman. And Ed, you're at
Ed Gross.
Nice.
Keep people updated on what's going on with the books. And when we can announce the next book, I think people are going to be super excited. And we'll be super excited when it's done.
That's for sure.
The bane of our existence right now.
And then you're going to start working on your Tales from the Gold Monkey book and your Voyagers book. Remember Voyagers with the little
of course, and Powers of Matthew Starr. Look, nothing would make us happier than a new book about sci-fi in the 70s on TV, where we could do Buck Rogers and we could do Manimal and we could do Super Train. But no one would buy it other than you. So, we got to pay the bills here, right?
Hey,
you know,
it's I think there's more people that would buy those than you're giving credit for.
I know. You know what? The problem, unfortunately, is convincing the marketing and sales departments who run the numbers and projections that there is interest. And I think we would have a tough time. But believe me, God, that would be, I keep saying, like, I'm like Michael Corleone. I keep saying it's my last book. I keep trying to get out, but they pull me back in. So like, that's one I would come back and do because that would be awesome.
Just an oral history of science fiction television in America, you know, Space 1999, Buck Rogers, all those shows.
The sci-fi 70s.
Yes.
You know, there's so many great stories. Like, you know, for this next book, I was talking to the director and he started talking to me about some other stuff he did, like $6 Million Man. And we were talking about The Invisible Man and Gemini Man and Magnum.
Auto Man in the 80s with
Auto Man. Yeah. Holmes and Yo-Yo. I mean, it just, and it was like, oh man, I wish I could write about all this stuff.
Desi Arnaz Jr.
I mean, it's just like incredible. It's incredible. I mean, what's almost more incredible is a couple years back, they said they were going to make a Manimal TV movie, which I couldn't believe. But, you know, you heard the big news recently is that they are, ABC just picked up Greatest American Hero as a pilot for next season. So it'd be amazing to see Greatest American Hero come back, because that's a show that had enormous potential that was never quite executed properly. And it'd be really great to see with today's technology and, what the potential for that show. I mean, I'd be very curious to see this reboot of Greatest American Hero.
I will totally admit Connie Selica was one of my first ever crushes.
Yeah, I can see that. For me, it was Maren Jensen on at Galactica until I realized she couldn't act. I hear you.
Well, no, with the Greatest American Hero, just to hope they do either put the original theme song or have a nice update on that theme song. A hip-hop version of that song, absolutely.
I have the Greatest American Hero, the complete DVDs, including when they tried to reboot it with the new character.
Yeah.
And they had the female Greatest American Hero. I got all that.
Wow.
Well, I guess his new one is a female Greatest American. I mean, it would be an
Indian American actress is playing her.
Nice.
Yeah, I wonder if that William Catt will be like the Bill Culp version in this.
Or that would be hilarious.
You know, I mean, it's such a shame that Bill Culp died, because he was always so great. You know, he's so great in that show.
When will William Catt reboot Perry Mason?
That's a good question. I think you're going to be waiting a while.
Rebooting Perry Mason.
Well, once again, book is Slayers and Vampires, because we're going to just keep going. It's like, hey, what about
John's job in this particular episode is to keep us on track.
I do my best. Keep plugging the book, John.
That's what I'm here for. Yeah. So again, Slayers and Vampires, it's going to be available everywhere in print, in ebook, in audiobook. Go and check it out. Go and check out Mark and Ed at Comic-Con in October, and they're going to be doing a bunch of panels, and I'm sure you can follow them both on Twitter. And if you dig what we do, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Anything else from anybody before we got to go?
Thanks, guys.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
No problem.
Love your shirt, man.
Yes, Ed's wearing a great shirt there. Very good. All right, everybody, have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
You too.
Very much.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.